loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Donald Trump and the CIA have reportedly decided to end the covert arming of Syrian rebels. But were these forces ever really, quote, moderate? And does this really signal a major policy change of the U.S. government in Syria? Today marks 6 months since Donald Trump became the 45th president of the United States. We'll take a look at how his first half year in office contrasts with his campaign promises. We'll talk about the freewheeling and strange interview Trump gave this week to the New York Times. U.S. lawmakers have introduced legislation to make participation in the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement in solidarity with Palestine a crime punishable by up to 20 years in prison. This is the latest in a long-running campaign of repression against pro-Palestinian activities here in the United States. But first, we turn towards U.S. policy in Syria. Donald Trump has announced, or his administration has announced, that it's ending the covert program to train so-called armed opposition fighters in Syria. We are joined from the Bay Area in California by Rick Sterling. He is an investigative journalist and a member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. Welcome back, Rick.
Yeah, hi, Brian.
Rick, before we get started, I want to play a short audio clip. It's President Obama speaking in September 2014 about the U.S. program, or the Obama administration's program, to train and equip moderate Syrian rebels. Let's listen to Barack Obama for a moment.
I'm pleased that Congress, a majority of Democrats and a majority of Republicans in both the House and the Senate, have now voted to support a key element of our strategy, our plan to train and equip the opposition in Syria so they can help push back these terrorists. As I said last week, I believe that we're strongest as a nation when the President and Congress work together. And I want to thank leaders in Congress for the speed and seriousness with which they approach this urgent issue, in keeping with the bipartisanship that is the hallmark of American foreign policy at its best.
Okay, that was Barack Obama in September 2014. Rick, there's a number of elements there. He says it's bipartisan, the majority of Democrats and the majority of Republicans, that it's part of a strategy to arm Syrian opposition fighters so that they can fight the terrorists, when, of course, as we have learned, and as you know, and as you have reported, the people getting the arms from the United States were, in fact, themselves the terrorists. Go ahead.
Right. Well, that was that grant was $500 million. And 1 year later, they were highly embarrassed when it came out in testimony that the grand total of trainees was 54, and that those 54 was reduced to something like 4 because almost all of them turned over their sophisticated military weaponry supplied by the U.S. and joined Nusra, which is the al-Qaeda branch in Syria. So basically, the CIA program taking $500 million of U.S. taxpayers' money was used to support al-Qaeda.
So here you had $500 million to support moderate rebels so that they could fight the terrorists. And of course, as you're pointing out, the number was down to actually 4 individuals who had been, quote, vetted and given all this money and given weapons. But most of the weapons were then turned over to al-Qaeda. Was that a surprise to the Pentagon? Was that a surprise to the Obama administration or to the CIA? Did they know that these weapons were going to al-Qaeda? When, of course, for our audience, which on this one doesn't really need to be reminded, but the whole so-called war on terror, which began right after September 11, 2001, it's all been about al-Qaeda. But here the U.S. is giving arms to al-Qaeda. Did they know it?
Well, it was certainly an embarrassment to them when it was publicly revealed. There's always been a lot of deception in what's going on there. You know, even this term moderate rebels, what does a moderate opposition person mean when in Syria there actually is a moderate opposition in Syria? They're not carrying weapons and AK submachine guns and launching mortars. They're actually in the political process in Syria. Now, I've met personally with some of the leaders of the political opposition in Syria. And in contrast with the what the U.S. calls the moderate opposition are basically militants, extremists, terrorists of one sort or another. Even this the infamous group Nur al-Din al-Zenki, which actually video recorded itself beheading a young Palestinian Syrian boy, they're included among the so-called moderate rebels. So it's always been a lot of deception and deceit going on. With the overthrow of Gaddafi in the fall of 2011, the CIA came in and started shipping. They basically stole the warehouse of weapons owned by the Libyan government and started shipping them to Syria to provide weapons to the so-called moderate rebels, who are basically militants killing Syrian civilians, killing Syrian army and other people there.
Okay, so let's just get it straight. The chronology: the U.S. There's the Arab Spring, the Egyptian Revolution, the Tunisian Revolution, that ended in the overthrow of Mubarak, who had been a U.S. puppet. But then protests started in the eastern part of Libya in Benghazi. Of course, there's lots of reasons to protest against any government, and undoubtedly there were legitimate and valid reasons. But immediately, the U.S. seized on what happened in Libya and started armed groups that turned out to also be, as Gaddafi was warning, that they might be, that they were jihadi al-Qaeda type groups. So they overthrow Gaddafi. He's lynched in the street, 70-year-old head of state. Hillary Clinton says that day we came, we saw he died. She said that laughingly on videotape. And what you're saying is that emboldened by their success in Libya and toppling the regime change, it was the U.S. and the CIA that just started funneling all of these weapons, including weapons from Libya that had been under the old Gaddafi government, to terrorist organizations in Syria. That's your assertion.
That's correct. And it's not just my assertion. It actually was revealed publicly in a classified Defense Intelligence Agency report that emerged from secrecy during the Benghazi hearings. There was a Freedom of Information Act request that was granted, and this DIA report, dated August of 2012, documented the U.S. involvement in the shipment of weapons from Libya to support so-called moderate rebels in Syria. And it also documented the fact that the conflict in Syria is driven by the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda. That's explicitly stated in the DIA report.
In June 2015, the Long War Journal reported, quote, "In a new video released by the Islamic State, the jihadist group shows the capture of the ancient city of Palmyra, also known as Tadmur in Arabic. During the video, at least one U.S.-made BGM-71 TOW anti-tank missile is seen being used against Syrian regime troops near the city." And the April al-Masdar News reported that Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, the current name at that time taken on by al-Qaeda in Syria, deployed U.S.-supplied anti-tank missiles to full effect today as jihadist militants immobilized at least one Syrian Arab army tank during a counterinsurgency operation in rural Aleppo. The SAA, that's the Syrian Arab Army's T-72 tank, was destroyed by a TOW anti-tank missile fired from a trench of HTS militants. So, I mean, if the people of the United States thought that the U.S. government was sending anti-tank weapons, I mean, significant weapons, advanced weapons, to al-Qaeda, don't you think people in the United States, average people, would be, I don't know, up in arms about that?
Absolutely. They absolutely would. And Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard has a very, very clear, straightforward, and very positive resolution in Congress: stop arming terrorists. Rand Paul has taken the same resolution into the Senate. Unfortunately, it's received little publicity, and the number of co-sponsors is quite low, actually. But that would be a very positive thing for the U.S. to stop arming terrorists. it's good news that Trump is and reportedly McMaster was involved in the decision as well to stop to end the CIA train and equip program. That's a positive sign, but we'll have to see how it plays out, because from early on we've seen a lot of deception, and one thing is said and another thing is done, and there are even competing factions within the U.S. intelligence community, the CIA, and within the Department of Defense also. We saw that last September when Secretary of State Kerry came to an agreement with the Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov, where the U.S. was going to start coordinating more with the Russian military in their airstrikes against ISIS. And that was sabotaged when the U.S. Air Force, with some of their other coalition members, attacked the Syrian army instead of ISIS and killed at least 80 Syrian soldiers and wounded 100, and allowed ISIS to recapture a strategic area near the city of Deir ez-Zor.
Yeah, I remember that. And the other thing about that was the debate between the Pentagon and the State Department was quite open. You had Ash Carter, Secretary of Defense, and the uniformed officers opposing any ceasefire agreement that Obama was trying to make with Kerry back in September, I believe it was, 2016. So there was a debate in the cabinet meeting. Obama finally says, yes, I'm for the ceasefire. They announced the ceasefire with the Russians. And 3 days later or something, the Pentagon bombs that fixed Syrian Arab Army position. It wasn't a mistake. It wasn't like a fluid position where it was held by the terrorists and then by the Syrian government. They were there. The Pentagon knew they were there. And they bombed the heck out of them. And then Syria said, okay, guess what? The ceasefire is off. I want to move on because we only have a limited amount of time, and I have quite a bit to cover with you, Rick Sterling. We're speaking with Rick Sterling. He's an investigative journalist and a member of the Syria Solidarity Network. A current U.S. official told the Washington Post on condition of anonymity, quote, about the cessation of arms to the armed groups in Syria, this is a momentous decision. Putin won in Syria. Okay, that's a U.S. official, unnamed, in the Washington Post saying Trump's decision is a win for Putin. How do you see it?
No, it's not a win for Putin. It's a win for common sense, as well as the American public and the Middle East at large. I think the problem is that any positive move like this is going to be spun by the opponents in a way that denigrates the decision. And we've seen the Reuters report specifically refers to this decision being an appeasement to Russian President Vladimir Putin. So this is the neocons, and those who want to continue the conflict in Syria are going to be kind of subverting this decision and opposing it. So that's how I see that. They're distorting the nature of it, and they're not. I mean, you almost never see in the mainstream media that arming militants to attack a sovereign state is a violation of international law. It's in the UN Charter, and the International Court of Justice decided on this in 1986 when they ruled that the U.S. arming and supporting of the Contras in Nicaragua was a violation of international law.
And talking about a violation of international law, which the Washington Post, as you say, obviously doesn't give a darn about, the U.S. presence in Syria is still not a legal presence under Trump. I mean, you have a lot of U.S. troops there and a lot of U.S. military installations. They haven't been invited into Syria by the sovereign government, according to the U.N. Charter and international law. Countries can't just send armies into another member state of the U.N. except in conditions of imminent self-defense. You can't just bomb a country. Now, Turkey's state-run a news agency has also revealed what it claims to be the locations of 10 U.S. military bases in the Kurdish-controlled areas of northern Syria. I'm reading from Al Monitor now, a move that will likely put a further dent in the rocky relationship between the two NATO allies. The news agency dropped its bombshell, complete with maps pinpointing the locations of U.S. special forces in Kobani, Manbij, and Rumelan, among others, via its Turkish language service this week. I mean, these are pretty dramatic developments, too, because, of course, Turkey is the eastern flank of NATO. NATO is a U.S.-led military alliance. And now you have Turkish military revealing U.S. military base positions in Syria. Go ahead and talk about that.
Well, yeah, that's very interesting, and it's a sign of the deterioration of relations between the U.S. and Turkey. You've got a whole nest of governments and organizations that have all been trying to overthrow the Syrian government from different standpoints with different motivations and reasons that are all falling out amongst themselves. Of course, there's the conflict in the Gulf between Saudi Arabia and Qatar. Now you've got the U.S. at odds with Turkey. In Idlib province, two of the major terrorist organizations, the Nusra, is at in conflict with Ahrar al-Sham, another one of the terrorist groups. So you've got conflict going on all over the place between countries and organizations that used to be working together, trying to, in one way or another, they were all united in trying to overthrow the Syrian government. And it's really a testament to the resilience of the Syrian government and their allies that they've withstood this incredible attack. 100,000 terrorists from around the world recruited to go to Syria, all of them paid. Terrorists and mercenaries within Syria funded with billions of dollars annually from some of the richest and most powerful countries in the world. And amazingly enough, Syria has withstood this, thanks in part due to the support from the Lebanese resistance, Hezbollah, thanks in part due to the support from Iran and also Russia. But the Syrians have paid the heavy price, and it's really a testament to their own steadfastness that they have survived. And it's also a testament to the fact that the war was never what it was claimed to be. It was never a sectarian. Syria was never the sectarian place that it was said to be, an Alawi dictatorship. It's always been united in a secular progressive politics. They've got their flaws, but they've basically been politically strong, and you've got a strong unity within Syria between the Sunni community, the Shia community, the Alawi community, the Christian community. All of these communities are really clear, and that's something that we never hear in the West, sadly enough.
Yeah, I think it is sad, and I think it's bad, and I think the American people, as a consequence, don't really know what's going on. The Syrian Arab Army, for instance, because Syria is a majority Sunni country, even though there are many ethnic groups and religious minorities, including the Alawites, but the Syrian Arab Army is majority Sunni, of course, because the country is majority Sunni, and that army has lost more than 100,000 soldiers fighting against terrorist organizations. It's seen its dog days in 2011, 2012, and yet it remained intact. It would not have this major armed force if it was simply a sectarian conflict between the Shiite-led Assad government and the Sunni majority. That army would have not, you know, it would never have retained its validity, its unitary intactness. That's certainly true. We have about 90 seconds left. I want you, Rick Sterling, because you are a journalist, you've been paying attention to Syria, you actually know what's going on. When you look at the big picture now, as Turkey has pointed out, all these U.S. military bases in the northern part of Syria aligned with the Kurds, what happens next? What happens next? We have 1 minute left.
Well, we're at the critical point where the U.S. and allies are going to recognize that the regime change effort has not succeeded, and they're going to start winding down and backing down. And that's why this decision regarding the CIA training program, ending that, is a positive step. The question is going to be whether that's going to be followed through with and whether it's going to be reversed or not by neocons and some of their allies who are just obsessed with anti-Russia and obsessed with doing whatever they can to continue and even escalate the conflict. There's a lot of talk of attacking Iran. You know, some of the major hawks in government and in the media are not going to give up. So we're going to have to see how things play out over the coming weeks and months. But it's approaching a critical point where the U.S. is going to have to either decide, well, it did not succeed, and we're going to move away from support for terrorism in Syria, or not.
Well, that's all the time we have. We've been joined from the Bay Area in California by Rick Sterling. He is an investigative journalist and a member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Today marks 6 months since Donald Trump became the 45th president of the United States. We'll look at how his first half year in office contrasts with his campaign promises, as well as the very interesting, well, I don't know, perhaps very strange interview that Trump did with the New York Times yesterday. We are joined from Atlanta again by Anoa Changa. She is the host of The Way with Anoa. And from New York by Brandon Sutton, the host of The Discourse. Welcome, Anoa and Brandon.
Thank you.
It's lovely to be here.
Thank you so much. Here's what the Washington Post has an article. On Thursday, President Trump, this was from yesterday, will have been in office for 181 days, a.k.a. 4,344 hours, a.k.a. 260,640 minutes, a.k.a. 6 months. My first reaction is only 6 months. Perhaps it's because so much has happened in those 6 months. And perhaps it feels like time has slowed down because, paradoxically, Trump has not overseen many tangible policy changes since becoming president. Anoa, let's start with you. That's kind of true, but things have gone, I don't know, so dynamically, but nothing really has been achieved in from the point of view of Trump's so-called campaign promises.
This has been a really interesting 6 months, I think, you know, out of the different, you know, presidential election cycles that I've been keenly aware and paying attention to. I do think that, I mean, we've seen, out of everything that we've seen that Donald Trump has, I guess, promised or tried to do the most, I don't know that someone could argue successful, has been the attempt at, you know, the ban in terms of what his administration tried to say is not a Muslim ban, but he himself has said it was a Muslim ban, with the Supreme Court actually upholding parts of that. This whole 6 month period, it seems like it's been forever, but it's hard to believe it's only been 6 months that we've been having these conversations and looking at things unfold. I mean, he and other members of his administration have made, you know, certain commentary on the world stage in terms of wanting to withdraw from NATO. It's been a lot of higher and talk because, for the most part, what Trump has actually done has been very much in line with, you know, the standard bearer line of Republican Party. I mean, yes, there's the inflammatory stuff that he says. What he's actually doing, the partnerships he's actually making, the people he's actually meeting with, it's actually pretty much in line with what has been done in subsequent administrations. It might be to another level of extreme beyond what is actually in the interest of the people. But I'm trying to see. I mean, he's in the New York Times, you know, complaining that people aren't giving him enough time to actually prove himself. But it's been, I don't know what there's for him to prove.
I want to go to that interview with the New York Times. Brandon, we're going to play a short clip because some of it, I mean, obviously, Trump wanted to have the interview. He brought the Times reporters into the Oval Office yesterday on the eve of the 6 month. Let's hear a short audio clip from Trump talking about his attorney general, and then I want to get your reaction to it.
Sessions gets the job. Right after he gets the job, he recuses himself.
Was that a mistake?
Well, Sessions should have never recused himself. And if he was going to recuse himself, he should have told me before he took the job, and I would have picked somebody else.
Mm-hmm. He gave you no heads up at all. Mm-hmm.
Zero. So Jeff Sessions takes the job, gets into the job, recuses himself. I then have, which frankly, I think is very unfair to the president. How do you take a job and then recuse yourself?
Okay, that was not Donald Trump in studio. That was Donald Trump interviewed by the New York Times yesterday in the Oval Office. The New York Times issued a short audio clip about it. Brandon Sutton, let me just ask you, Jeff Sessions today says, no, I want to stay. I have a lot to do. Doesn't sound like Donald Trump really wants him to stay. What's your take?
I mean, let's just look at the language that Donald Trump uses in that, you know, that clip right there. It's unfair. It was unfair to the president. It was unfair to, you know, me, really, what he's saying. And I think that's really indicative. That kind of petulance and victim complex and like vague narcissism has been the, I think what Anoa rightly pointed out, has been the sort of key factor in his presidency so far that distinguishes him from presidents we've had so far. This very narcissistic personality, this very, you know, victim complex. A lot of this is also like just how desperately he wants the approval of the media. Like you can hear it in his sort of tone that he speaks the New York Times with, like, oh, like it's all unfair to me. Like, I think we can all agree that it was the right move, you know, not only sort of the right move legally for, you know, Sessions to recuse himself, but politically, it made sense in terms of optics for him to recuse himself. But Donald Trump is not worried about that. He's worried about, you know, like himself, really.
Yeah, I hear you on that. That was Brandon Sutton. Noah, you know, another piece of the Times interview sort of verifies, completely validates this kind of narcissism with Trump. Here he is telling the reporters, they ask him, I don't think I've seen you look like you were enjoying yourself that much since the convention, really, meaning the Republican convention. Trump responds, I've had the best reviews on foreign land. So I go to Poland and I make a speech. Enemies of mine in the media, enemies of mine are saying it was the greatest speech ever made on foreign soil by a president.
The stupidity and just, you know, piggybacking on all of this, like, I don't know, some people delve into whether or not there's mental illness at work. I think that's really an insult to the many Americans who do actually, you know, struggle with mental illness. I think Brandon is actually right, and others who point to the narcissism. And just, I mean, Trump is a system of the way our, you know, the duopoly works, and propping up problematic figures for whatever, you know, anyone else's, you know, objectives are, and letting them run amok on our country. And it is disturbing. And his response to how challenging the role has been, even through, you know, post-convention and certainly the first six months of governance, is that, well, when I go to other countries, people love what I have to say. And it's like, okay, one, what news do you read? Like, clearly you're not reading the news of what other people say in these other countries.
Right. He said Saudi Arabia and Poland, the two countries hosting him, gave him a great reception, as if he was somewhat, like, shocked or surprised by that.
Right.
There are things that are coming through in that interview, though, that make it clear that Trump is dealing with odds and problems that maybe other presidents haven't been coping with. In the interview, for instance, Trump said that he believed Mr. Comey told him about the Steele dossier. That's the one where Trump was allegedly in Moscow with prostitutes doing this, that, and the other thing. And he goes on to implicitly make it clear he had something to hold over the president. Quote, in my opinion, he shared it so that I would think he had it out there, Mr. Trump said. As leverage, the Times journalist asked. Yeah, I think so, Mr. Trump said, in retrospect. Meaning the first time, Brandon, that Donald Trump met alone with James Comey, then FBI director, on January 6th, right before taking office, it was James Comey who cleared the room at Trump Tower. He told the other officials to leave, and then he meets privately with Trump and says, look, I have this dossier that says you're in a hotel in Moscow with prostitutes doing all of these amazingly, you know, sort of obscene pornographic things. And I'm just telling you this in private. Wouldn't you, if you were Donald Trump, perhaps think, hey, that's the protocol. That's what happens when I'm going to meet with the FBI director. I think it's important because Comey later says he's memorializing all of his discussions with Trump precisely because he fears being alone in the room with Trump. But actually, it was Comey, the FBI director, who started that process. Go ahead, Brandon.
Well, I think anyone who is saying that, you know, James Comey, the head of the FBI, the man who once wrote a justification for torture, is a good person who's only acting in, you know, some sort of virtuous regard for, you know, the sanctity of American democracy, and he sees Trump as some sort of unique threat, is just, you know, out of their mind. Right. The FBI is a political organization that has its own issues and its own problems. And if you're telling me that James Comey may have said that to Donald Trump, maybe. Right. Maybe. I think the problem with, you know, in that sort of narrative is that despite Donald Trump politically, in a lot of ways, just being excessive incarnation of the Republican Party, like his personality is very, very erratic. So, like, he is not the kind of person who would take a threat like that and, you know, deal with it the way a rational actor would, which would be like, okay, well, I'm going to sit on this, you know, I'm going to dig up my own dirt. He fires him or he does something like that.
Brandon, let me jump in. When he fired Comey, don't you think, I think this, and I want to ask, you're in a Noah's position, don't you think that Trump, again, I don't think very astute politically, but he thought that the Democrats would applaud the firing of James Comey because they themselves have been attacking Comey for his role in the what they consider to be his decisive role in the defeat of Hillary Clinton. I think he wanted to get rid of Comey all along, didn't trust him, felt he was trying to have leverage over him. So he thought, hey, I'm going to fire Comey, being the astute politician that he's not, And everybody's going to applaud. And then he's shocked that the Democrats who've been hating on James Comey suddenly say, you know what, James Comey perhaps is the only thing that's saving the country, the only thing standing between the country and the abyss. What do you think about that, both of you?
I mean, I think that's a fair interpretation. I think that a lot, if we interpret a lot of what Trump does, you know, a lot of his statements, a lot of his actions as looking for approval, they make sense, right? Various types of approval for, you know, whether it's bombing Syria or escalating tensions with North Korea. Like he is looking for approval from various actors within the political elite, right? Whether it be the media or Democratic Party or Republicans. And I think that interpretation speaks volumes about why he even ran in the first place, because he claims a billionaire, whatever. He was, you know, despite giving all his money to both parties, he was never really part of that political elite class. He was always still an outsider. And now that he's president, that desire to get approval has not waned in any way. Look at his reaction to his, you know, approval ratings. You know, it's really just this pathological need for approval from basically all sides.
Yeah, I know, Chenga, that's undoubtedly true about Donald Trump. I totally agree with Brandon about it. But even though he wants the approval of the elites and, of course, the media, he also needs the approval of the people. In terms of approval rating, after 6 months, it's been exactly 6 months now, a recent Washington Post ABC News poll put the approval rating at 36%. ABC News called it the lowest six-month approval rating of any president in polls dating back 70 years. Two questions. Can Trump fix that? And secondly, Hillary Clinton's approval ratings happen to be even lower, which is, to me, not surprising, I guess, but still quite a shock. Go ahead.
The approval ratings, I always wonder, who are people, you know, who are people polling? Like, who gets polled for these types of things? But that's a whole other story. But one thing that I think is really interesting is Trump's, like, even his whole oblivious approach to everything, right, and blah, because everything is about him and how it affects him and not how he, as a person, is governing the nation, right? And even we go back to thinking about how upset he is about, about obsession, not informing him ahead of time that he's going to recuse his, or the fact that Sessions didn't answer questions. He's like, he gave bad answers or something like that during his hearing. It's all of that is about him and how it makes him look. Not the fact that Sessions is doing things that seem to be consistent with the agenda that he and other members of his wing have shown support for, such as like the DOJ asset forfeiture rule that Sessions is reinstituting as of yesterday. So there are things that are happening that seem to be kind of in line with what they're saying they want to push for the country, but it doesn't seem like that's really phasing Trump. He's really focused on, you know, himself and how things make him look. And if he tunes out, like he's on Twitter, he has Twitter battles with people, but he tunes out any valid and viable criticism because someone so loves him, or he held hands with the president of France and everything was fine.
Right. You know, it's so true. I mean, what both of you are saying is so true. The New York Times reporters, about when they asked Trump about the failure of the Republicans to pass a health care bill, to repeal and replace Obamacare. It's not about people, and it's not about patients. And, of course, we all as people become patients at some point, even though, you know, the health care industry wants to pretend that we're just customers. We're not people who get sick, or our kids get sick and they have to go to the doctor. But here we have in America so much suffering on health care, and the Republican plan is designed to make it worse. And here's what Trump says in response to a question about the failure to get the Republican health care bill through. Quote, Hillary Clinton was in there 8 years and they never got Hillary care, whatever they called it at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not in here 6 months and they'll say Trump hasn't fulfilled his agenda, close quote. I say to myself, wait a minute, I'm only here a very short period of time compared to Obama. How long did it take to get Obamacare? Of course, it took 14 months. But again, it's not. There's no empathy, there's no sympathy, there's no focus. Like most politicians, at least in the past, pretended to care about people. They introduced policies that they promised would make people's lives better. It seems to have gone in the opposite direction. The Republican plan is how can we take and rip health care away from people who may have it, especially poor people on Medicaid. And yet here it is, Donald Trump, 6 months in, saying, Well, just gauge my job, not based on whether I'm able to meet people's needs, but how I did in comparison to Obama and Hillary. Go ahead, Brendan.
Well, I think in that regard, we have to look at, you know, what Donald Trump really is for Republican Party, and that's a convenient scapegoat. And I've always been resistant to even calling this Trump care because this bill, you know, the bills, the various incarnations of this repeal and replace bill have been, it could not be more, you know, run-of-the-mill GOP. They could only be more GOP that they also declared war against another Middle Eastern country at the same time. That's what these bills are. And like, in my opinion, Donald Trump probably has, you know, as a reactionary position, if you ask him about healthcare, he probably has a better, you know, policy position on healthcare than the most Republican party.
He used to support single payer.
Yeah. But so what this is like, you know, again, he just wants to get things done. He wants to fulfill campaign promises. He wants to, you know, not be seen as a loser. And that makes him dangerous because he might sign something like the AHCA or the most recent incarnation of the bill. And so, like, the Republican Party needs to be, and this comes down to a fair and Democratic Party side. The Republican Party needs to be made to hold their bill around their neck. These AHCA bills should not be branded as Trump care by Democrats. They need to be, you know, like, these need to be the death knells of the Republican Party, because like, these are draconian, barbaric bills. Like, they, you know, some of them would result in 32 million people being kicked off of health insurance by 2026. But there still seems to be this desire amongst, you know, Ted Lieu and Tim Kaine to pretend like this is politics as usual, and they can still reach across the aisle and work for a bipartisan solution to this.
Chuck Schumer actually said Trump and the Republicans should start over and reach back to the Democrats, and they'd be willing to work with them. I mean, Noah Chango, we have 30 seconds left. I mean, it seems like the so-called left, they're not left, they're not even liberals, but the Democratic Party, they will not stop in trying to conciliate with these far-right, wretched, anti-people policies no matter what. I mean, it seems almost part of their DNA. Go ahead, 30 seconds left.
No, I absolutely agree. And I think that both parties seem to have this insistent need to one-up each other versus actually do anything that serves the people in our best interest. You know, in that same New York Times article, Donald Trump talks about how it's hard to take entitlements away once you give them to people, and he makes reference to the pre-existing conditions thing. I mean, that's a pretty huge issue for many people, and it's not just that it's a quote-unquote entitlement for the people they feel entitled to. It's literally a matter of life and death for folks. And so seeing the way the different parties are willing, the two major parties are willing to play poker with our lives, with our livelihoods, with our health, it's rather disconcerting. And I'm not really confident in what could happen if they do go back to the drawing board to work with Schumer and others, considering the way they do make decisions.
Yeah, I hear you. Working class and poor people feel entitled to live. How dare they? Anyway, we've been joined from Atlanta by Anoa Chenga, the host of The Way with Anoa, and from New York by Brendan Sutton, host of The Discourse. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. U.S. lawmakers have introduced legislation to make participation in the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement in solidarity with Palestine a crime punishable by up to 20 years in prison. This is the latest in a long-running campaign of repression against pro-Palestine activities in the United States. We are joined in studio by activist and author Miko Peled. He is the author of the book, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, as well as the upcoming book, Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. Welcome back, Miko.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here.
Talk about the new legislation. And as I was just saying before we started, I was telling all the people who work here, don't forget you're living in the free world where you have freedom of speech, right?
Well, I just hope to be in a cell with all the fun people, because there's going to be a lot of people going to jail if this law really passes. I think, you know, on a serious note, it is it's absurd from any possible way you look at it. But the most absurd thing about it is that this law, I mean, not the law, excuse me, the call for a boycott, divestment, and sanctions, the BDS demands, have nothing to do with Jews, have nothing to do with anti-Semitism at all. They talk about ending the military occupation, equal rights for Palestinians, and the right of return of Palestinians to their homes and their land, all things that have been internationally accepted and enshrined in international law and United Nations resolutions. There's nothing new there, and there's absolutely nothing that it talks about harming the Jews, kicking the Jews out, anything at all. It's all remedial. It's all fixing the problems that exist for Palestinians.
Yeah, and you know what makes me, you know, what's shocking about this is that if anyone has even a minor sense of U.S. history, when Martin Luther King Jr. was using the boycott in the South, in the southern part of the United States where apartheid existed as a legal formation, in other words, the police state against black people, people calling for boycotts of white-owned businesses and segregated businesses were also criminalized. And yet, here we have, in the year 2017, members of the U.S. Congress trying to do the same thing, criminalizing those who have a boycott against apartheid.
And it's interesting, too, because, you know, the claim is that somehow BDS, you know, the call for boycott is the call for boycott, divestment and sanctions somehow is somehow anti-Semitic. So it's okay to boycott Germany. It's okay to boycott Iraq. It's okay to boycott Iran. It's okay to boycott Russia. It's okay to boycott anybody but the Jews, but the Jewish state. That is anti-Semitic. That is discrimination against Jews. It's absolutely insane. Not to mention the fact that so many Jewish people participate and support the call for boycott against the state of Israel. And like I said before, the call for boycott, the demands of the BDS movement have nothing to do with the Jews. They don't harm the Jews. They don't call for harming the Jews. They are remedial. They are there in order to fix the problems that Israel created for the Palestinians. And really, they're the most reasonable demands you can expect from any national liberation movement.
Exactly. And we have to overcome this sort of taboo where if you criticize the state of Israel or apartheid or the policies of organizations like AIPAC, then you are anti-Semitic, which, of course, is their calling card. But nobody would think, Amico, if you criticize apartheid in South Africa, that means you're anti-white. If you criticize segregation in Alabama in 1955, that you were against white people because you wanted black people to have rights. And yet, I want to just read a little bit about this new law from The Intercept. This is from The Intercept. The criminalization of political speech and activism against Israel has become one of the gravest threats to free speech in the West. In France, activists have been arrested and prosecuted for wearing T-shirts advocating a boycott of Israel. The UK has enacted a series of measures designed to outlaw such activism. In the U.S., governors compete with one another over who can implement the most extreme regulations to bar businesses from participating in any boycott aimed at Israeli settlements. These are in illegally occupied territories. Now a group of 43 senators, 29 Republicans, and 14 Democrats want to implement a law that would make it a felony for Americans to support the international boycott against Israel. What are they so afraid of?
Yeah, I think they're afraid that the money would run out. I think they're afraid that AIPAC would support their opponents at the next elections. I mean, that's the only explanation. That's really the only explanation. It has nothing to do with anything reasonable. It's a First Amendment right issue. Anybody who respects and has any kind of regard and caring for free speech, the issue of free speech is going to come out against this. I think they're putting themselves in the corner that's going to be very hard for them to get out of, because it's an absolutely absurd proposition to pass a law that makes it illegal to call for boycott. I mean, it's a crazy idea, especially here in the United States, where the First Amendment is such an important thing. But it's all about Israel. It's all about the Israeli lobby. It's all about they must be feeling some kind of a pinch from the Israeli lobby to do this. And they have to always be ahead of the game somehow, and more Catholic than the Pope, more Zionist than the Zionists. And that's what it is. And on a deeper level, I think it only demonstrates how powerful the whole BDS movement has become, how influential the BDS movement has become, and how people are realizing that it is a dedicated, justified, and form of resistance against a real injustice. And as we sit here in this heat here in Washington, D.C., enjoying a glass of cold water and air conditioning, there are 2 million people in Gaza in similar heat with no access to clean water, with no electricity. 2 million people. Babies are dying. Old people are dying. People have no access to medicine. And somebody wants to tell me that calling for a boycott against a state that creates that environment in Gaza, that places 2 million people in that prison, is somehow anti-Semitic, is somehow wrong. It's exactly the opposite. Supporting the state of Israel, supporting a regime that imposes such life on 2 million people, that is racism and that is anti-Semitism.
You're listening to the voice of Miko Peled. He is the author of The General Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Miko is also the author of an upcoming book, Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. Anti-Semitism is real, of course. We know that. Anybody who lives in the United States knows that there's always in the backdrop the possibility of anti-Semitism rising up. We've seen a rise of it. But there's an anti-Islamic movement that is perhaps stronger at this point, more perfidious all over the place. And it didn't just start under Donald Trump with the Muslim ban. It's been going on for some time. You just wrote the book, The Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. Those guys are in jail for what? What happened? Talk about your book.
Five good men who are Muslim Palestinian Americans are in federal prison for many, many years. Two of them for 65 years, one for 20, and two for 15 years. And they were involved in what used to be the largest Muslim charity in America, the Holy Land Foundation. It was a highly regarded, highly respected, highly trustworthy, and very effective charity organization that did many good things here in the U.S., overseas, and mostly in Palestine. And after 9/11, when it was time to, as they said, round up the usual suspects, then they were rounded up. Their assets were frozen. And from that moment on, and then in December of 2001, President Bush closed them down with an executive order and said that they were a major terrorist funding network. 7 years and two trials later, these guys were convicted in Dallas and sent to federal prison. There was absolutely no proof connecting them to terrorism. There was no proof connecting any money that they raised to terrorist organizations. But the U.S. government said, well, perhaps they were not giving money to Hamas, which was the terrorist organization they were talking about. They were giving money to local charity organizations, and those organizations, according to the government, are connected to Hamas. Now, there is a list of recognized designated terrorist organizations that the U.S. government puts out. None of these committees, they're called Zakat committees or charity committees, none of the committees or their board members have ever been on any of those lists. Other organizations like USAID and other international organizations work with those Zakat committees. So the only place where those committees are regarded as terrorist organizations or connected to Hamas is in a courtroom in the Northern District of Texas. So even though there was an enormous body of evidence that showed these men did nothing wrong, that they had no connection to any form of terrorism, the government was able to convict them, and now they're in federal prison, and it's a horrifying story. From the minute it began, from the minute they began prosecuting these men, all the way till today, when they're sitting in the way they're treated in prison and so forth because they're so-called terrorists, and it's a story that people need to know in America because we have five innocent men sitting in prison under horrifying condition. Their families have been impacted severely, and an entire community, which is a very positive, very productive, and that contributes a great deal, the Muslim and Arab American community, has been damaged greatly by this.
Who publishes the book?
Just World Books.
Okay. So the name of the book is Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. I went to Dallas. I spoke out at their fundraisers. I got a chance to meet them before they were sent to prison. I went there with former Attorney General, U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who was also campaigning for their freedom because it's such an obvious setup, frame up. They're political prisoners. You know, America says, oh, it's the rule of law. If there was a rule of law, these men would not be in prison.
They are political prisoners. The persecution of these men began with a document that was put out by the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, which, of course, pretends to be a civil rights organization, but is really a fascist right-wing organization, about terrorism in America. It came out in 1993. And in this document, they mention the Holy Land Foundation as one of the agents of terrorism, of Islamic terrorism here in the United States. And from that point on, there were newspaper articles condemning them and writing about them, and this whole process began. Within this story, the story within the story is the Boehm case, which is a case of a family whose son was living and going to school in the settlement of Beit El in the West Bank.
These are illegal settlements.
This is a settlement that is as illegal as can get in the heart of the West Bank, a fundamentalist Jewish high school that he went to, and he was shot and killed by Palestinians. So because of the laws that were passed here in the 90s, his family was able to sue the Holy Land Foundation. This is in the year 2000. They got a judgment of $156 million, I believe. But of course, that money doesn't exist. The Holy Land Foundation never had it. And the Holy Land Foundation, of course, was closed down. The five men are in jail. And now they're coming back and they're suing American Muslims for Palestine and the officers, particularly of this organization, AMP, saying that they are the alter egos of the Holy Land Foundation.
Well, wait a second. What's an alter ego?
I'm not sure what that means.
Okay, so somebody commits a murder, say, and somebody says, you know, the murderer or the alleged murderer, he's the alter ego of my cousin, Bill. Let's go for Bill.
So, and that's in the lawsuit. The alter ego term is in the lawsuit. They're saying, well, they're doing the exact same things. They support the same organization. These are actually the same people. Now, the problem with all of these allegations is, number one, it's never been established that Hamas was responsible for the death of David Boehm, the boy. Number two, it's never been established that anything the Holy Land Foundation had ever did has anything to do with Hamas and certainly had nothing to do with the death of David Boehm. So these things have in a U.S. court of law, these things have never been established. Now, this new allegation that somehow AMP is somehow connected to this is so – I mean, they are so far removed that it's absurd that you know, a judge didn't throw it out of court. On top of that, when we look at the way organizations are designated in the U.S. as terrorist organizations, there is no burden of proof. It's not like a court of law where you need to show
beyond. Right, it's a political decision. Like Cuba was on the terrorism list, and then Obama decided to normalize relations with Cuba or begin to. Yeah. It's okay, you're no longer terrorists.
So the whole thing is built on complete nonsense. It's complete hot air, and yet there's a court of law in the District of Chicago who's now dealing with this case, and these guys and these people are going to have to, you know, it's a witch hunt against Muslim organizations, particularly if they work with Palestine. It's a witch hunt against anything that has to do with Palestine, including charity, education. And it all stems from this idea that everything Palestinian is terrorism. And I think that needs to be reversed because nothing that's Palestinian is terrorism. Palestinians are fighting for their rights. They're struggling for liberation, whether they do through resistance, through charity, through education, through any other means. It is not terrorism. It is legitimate struggle for justice and freedom.
We're speaking with Mikko Peled. He is the son of an Israeli general. He's the author of the book, The General's Son, The Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, someone who became a fervent supporter of the Palestinian cause and the cause of Palestinian rights. Mikko, you know, a lot of people, when they hear terms like apartheid, they think, well, okay, South Africa, we understand, black people, white people separated, but they're not sure, is Israel an apartheid state? Now, you were just arrested as part of a protest in Israel, and you were telling me your story about your night in jail, but it sounded a lot like apartheid to me.
There's no question that Israel is an apartheid state. The very question is quite absurd. And I'll just tell you a quick anecdote. I was in South Africa a couple of years ago speaking I was invited by the BDS South Africa. And the Zionist groups invited an Israeli, and he and I were interviewed together. So I explained why Israel is an apartheid regime, and this was on TV live. And then the interviewer asked the Israeli, the other guy, he said, so how is it not an apartheid regime? And the guy, live on TV for about 20 seconds, sat there with his mouth open and had no answer. There is no way to explain the state of how Israel is not an apartheid state, because it always has been, from day one, an apartheid regime. Now, the story I was telling you earlier, I was arrested at a protest a few weeks ago, and this was in Nabi Saleh in the West Bank, and I was actually taken to jail this time, and I spent a night in jail. And what's interesting is the in the police car going to the jail, I was hearing them on the radio telling the jail, making sure they have a cell for a Jew. They said, I have a Jew with me. I have a Jew with you. Make sure you have a cell. Make sure you have room for a Jew, because Jews and Arabs are in separate cells, are in separate cells in the jail, in the prison. So that's one of those small examples, not to mention the fact that had I been a Palestinian arrested in the exact same place, violating the exact same laws, I probably would still be in jail. I would have been beaten and tortured, handcuffed, shackled, and blindfolded, and of course beaten. And who knows how long I would have been in a jail cell. As it was, I was in a jail cell for about 26 hours.
Okay, well, we have about 2 minutes left. When you say beaten, tortured, you're not being hyperbolic. This is actually what's happening to Palestinians who get arrested.
Oh, absolutely. It's a completely different reality. They'd be kicked and beaten as soon as they're caught. And then they'd be kicked and beaten in the police car. And then they'd be beaten and tortured. And they would not be able to see a lawyer until after they confess. You know, I saw a lawyer as soon as I was taken to the police. You know, I was able to talk to my lawyer immediately. So it's an entirely different law, a system of law. It's a completely, completely apartheid regime.
How many people are in Israeli prisons? How many Palestinians?
Right now, Israel has about a little over 6,000 prisoners in Palestinian jails. And by the way, another aspect, since we were talking about the Holy Land and about charities, I'll say this real quick. The State of Israel just closed down the Palestinian National Fund, which is a charity organization that was supporting the families of prisoners. Now, the vast majority of Palestinian prisoners in Israel have not been charged with violence. They are political prisoners. Yet the claim was that by supporting the families, you are supporting terrorism. You are encouraging terrorism somehow. That claim was made about the Holy Land Foundation as well here in the U.S. So there is this witch hunt against charities for Palestine right now going on all over the world.
Okay, we're out of time. We've been joined in studio by activist and author Miko Peled. He's the author of the book, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. He also has a new book, an upcoming book called Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. If you're in the Washington, D.C. metro area, you can hear us every day at 5 p.m. at 105.5 FM. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.